Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. He was a little Huck Finn, a little bit Hardy Boys, a touch of young Indiana Jones, and all Belgian. Tintin, boy reporter, boy hero, intrepid when that word meant something, and so thrilling in thick, child-bedazzling comic books from the mysterious Hergé, Tintin in the Congo, Cigars of the Pharaoh, Destination Moon, Tintin in Tibet. Now Steven Spielberg brings Tintin to the big screen. This hour on Point, the world of Hergé's classic boy marvel, Tintin. You can join the conversation. Did you grow up on Tintin with Snowy, Captain Haddock, Great Blue, Blistering Barnacles, Adventure by the Page? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Steven Spielberg first locked onto Tintin way back in Indiana Jones days in 1983 when Tintin's creator Hergé was on his deathbed. That's a story in itself. The film is finally out next week. Spielberg director Peter Jackson of Lord of the Rings fame producer. It's The Adventures of Tintin, The Secret of the Unicorn. Here's a little bit from the big film. Tintin, played by actor Jamie Bell, is taken prisoner and put to the test when he's questioned by the evil Ivan Ivanovich Sakharin, played by Daniel Craig, on the whereabouts of a clue that could lead to the long-lost treasure of the legendary ship, the Unicorn.
Where is it?
Where's what?
Oh, I am tired of your games. The scroll from the Unicorn, a piece of paper like this.
You mean the poem?
Yes.
The poem written in Old English?
Yes.
Was inside a cylinder.
Yes.
Concealed in the mast.
Yes.
I don't have it.
I will find it, with or without your help.
Steven Spielberg's new film, he's been captivated for years. Next Wednesday, it's out. The Adventures of Tintin, The Secret of the Unicorn. We're going to immerse ourselves in Tintin land this hour. Tintin, if you're French or Belgian, yes, we know. And all the story, behind the story of Hergé and all the rest. A little later in this hour, we'll talk with a Paris-born Tintin fan who bought his Tintin adventures straight off the left bank back when Tintin was young, read them crouched in the streets of Paris as a boy, happens to be my father-in-law, Papa Guichard. But first, with us now from Berlin is Michael Farr, top-tier expert on Tintin and the comic book series, biographer of Hergé, the creator of Tintin. The world's top Tintinologist. Like Tintin, a former foreign correspondent for Reuters and the Daily Telegraph, now he's the author of Tintin, 60 Years of Adventure, The Adventures of Hergé, Creator of Tintin. His big book, just reissued, is Tintin, The Complete Companion. Michael Farr, it's wonderful to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us from Berlin today.
Hello. Yes, it's a rain-swept Berlin here, very much like the Berlin which Tintin encountered in 1929 on his first adventure.
And that was Tintin in the Land of the Soviets. Take us back to the beginning here. Who was his creator, Hergé? What was he up to in Belgium? Where did Tintin come from?
Well, Tintin came from a sort of Boy Scout background, really. What happened was that Hergé, whose real name was Georges Rémy, he left school and ended up working in a newspaper office where he worked in the very boring subscriptions department. And he whiled away the time doing doodles and wasn't happy at all. But the editor's secretary noticed that he was good at drawing. Mm-hmm. So she pointed this out to the editor. And he was put to good use at different sections of the paper, the literary pages, the women's fashion, illustrating things at a time when newspapers, you know, didn't use so many photographs. And then the editor had the very bright idea of creating a children's supplement, which would come out every Thursday, which was a day of half day of school in Belgium. So mm-hmm. school children were back home early. And he put this young, he was only 21 years old, Hergé, in charge as its first editor. And in order to fill the pages of this children's supplement, which was called Le Petit Vingtième, he created Tintin. And he created Tintin having created a year or a few, two or three years before, a Boy Scout character called Totor, another alliteration of the T's, which he'd done for Boy Scouting magazine. So Totor the Boy Scout was the model for Tintin the reporter, who is very much like a sort of, you know, grown-up Boy Scout, putting things right and so on.
Brave, loyal, cool-headed, polite, with that funny tuft of hair up on top of his head. I read somewhere that his editor said, make us, the Belgian, very Catholic country, Hergé Catholic, said, make us a Catholic boy hero here that our readers can look up to. This is the Catholic newspaper of a stripe, I think.
Absolutely. So, you know, that made sense. And it was an instant success from that first Thursday. Suddenly the circulation of the newspaper soared, and every Thursday afterwards it doubled, quadrupled, and so on. And it was an amazing success. It was instant success. And Tintin, as you say, with his quiff and so on, and helping, you know, a great do-gooder, he actually had a physical model. And this was Hergé's younger brother, Paul, who was 5 years younger, also had reddish blonde hair and also a natural quiff. And he was the physical model for it. And he had just finished being a Boy Scout himself.
Here's a little bit from the 2003 documentary, Tintin et moi. I'm Tintin, father of Tintin, Hergé, explained in a series of taped 1970s interviews with Numa Sadoul what he saw in the character of Tintin.
Je constate maintenant que Tintin est une espèce d'émanation de moi-même, certainement, comme tous les autres personnages.
A little translation here. He says, I can now see that Tintin was a sort of projection of myself, just like all the other characters, because they are all part of me. Tintin is a projection of me, the hero without fear or flaws. It is how I would like to be, in any case, what I strove to be. Michael Farr is maybe the world's leading Tintinologist. No, maybe about it. No one could be quite what Tintin was in the end. Describe this character for us, if you would, Michael Farr. Beyond just the Boy Scout element here, flesh it on out for us. What kind of adventures, what kind of settings, and how did he act in these many, many settings, whether it was, you know, with Native Americans or on the moon or in Tibet? Who was Tintin?
Well, as you said in your introduction, which I thought was very good, he was above all intrepid. He could respond to any crisis. He's perpetually being thrown in the deep end. He's always in a tight corner, and he always finds a way out. And he's immensely capable, and he's immensely honest, and he really is somebody who's got his head screwed on. And I love that clip you had of Hergé himself speaking about him, because this is what Hergé really wanted to be himself, what he aspired to be. And the funny thing about it is, of course, that nobody is perfect, not even Tintin. Mm-hmm. And we have 11 years of Tintin from 1929 until 1940, where Tintin is heroically sort of sorting out all sorts of programs, only with the help of his faithful fox terrier, Snowy.
Yes.
But Hergé then decided that, of course, you know, you can be too perfect, and nobody is so perfect. So he needed to have a sort of a butt to this, a sort of counterpart, and that was the other side of his own character. So he created Captain Haddock, who is a very human person, somebody who loses his temper, somebody who swears, somebody who enjoys drinking. These were all sides of Hergé's character, you know, which also existed, the other side, made it all together more plausible. But we do have these early adventures without Haddock. And Steven Spielberg is very clever, because in this first film of his, he is writing about the secret. He's basing the film on The Secret of the Unicorn. But he's brought in The Crab with the Golden Claws, which is that great adventure from 1940, 1941, where we first meet the drunken Captain Haddock, who is then reformed by Tintin.
Over some time, here's a scene from, this is 1992, episode of Tintin in Tibet. This was from an international TV series based on the cartoon. And here's Captain Haddock, voiced by David Fox, going on one of his famous alliterated rants as he follows Tintin, voiced by Colin O'Meara, through the crowded streets of course, Kathmandu.
I know it's here somewhere, I'm just not sure where.
This is ridiculous. You're walking around like a sleepwalker with his eyes shut.
Look out!
Watch where you're going, you bumbling blob!
Няма! Туаться много фейк! Апати ёмана то ното!
met your match, eh, Captain?
You bumbling blob, blue blistering barnacles, and yet there comes this kind of stereotypical Chinese nyak-nyak gong thing in response. This was not exactly a 2011 PC creation at the beginning, Michael Farr.
No, certainly not. But you see, anything which was done in the early 30s, and, you know, look at America, look at Europe, mm-hmm. we viewed the world very differently then. You know, we were very patronizing. We were thought we had it all better than, you know, countries like Africa or Asia, and we could, you know, show them how to do things. And this was very much the attitude. And Tintin, we mentioned that he went to the Soviet Union on his first adventure,
yes.
which was sorting out the Bolsheviks.
It was very anti-communist in that adventure.
Very anti-communist. And his Hergé's idea was then immediately afterwards, he should go to America to criticize extreme capitalism. Mm. However, his editor had other ideas and said, no, we must first send him to Africa because we want young Belgians to be more familiar with this great Belgian colony. When I say great, I mean in terms of size, it was so huge. Mm. And we want them perhaps to, you know, become interested in it and perhaps become future colonial administrators.
The Belgian
so
he Congo, sent heart of darkness
huge,
and all the rest.
Absolutely, this huge, huge country. And that was the editor's idea. Hergé was not so enthusiastic. He didn't really want to send Tintin there, but, you know, he was quite junior, so he did what he was told, on condition that he can meet up with an American angle, and in fact Al Capone dealing in diamonds in the Congo, which then brings him to America in that third adventure. So there is a great link, and he does get the anti-capitalist or anti-extreme capitalist criticism in that third adventure.
It's all there sooner or later in The Adventures of Tintin. Steven Spielberg brings it to the big screen next week. We're talking about it this hour with great Tintinologist Michael Farr. You can join us. Did you grow up reading Tintin, following his adventures around the world? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the intrepid boy hero, boy reporter, world traveler, adventurer, Tintin, in theaters next week in Steven Spielberg's The Adventures of Tintin, The Secret of the Unicorn. Michael Farr is with us this hour, joining us today from Berlin, Germany, the world's top Tintinologist, author of Tintin, The Complete Companion, and much more. He knows the story of Tintin and Hergé and Captain Haddock and Snowy and all the rest inside and out. A little later in this hour, we're going to hear from someone who grew up in the heyday of Tintin. This was France, just a decade or so after Hergé began drawing and writing these cartoons. Robert Guichard happens to be my father-in-law. Here's a little bit more from Steven Spielberg's movie. Is a scene where the notoriously incompetent characters, Inspectors Thompson and Thompson, played by Simon Pegg and Nick Frost, drive Tintin mad as he does his best to put together clues, writing hurriedly on a scrap of newspaper.
Before he lost consciousness, Dawes tried to tell me something, and I think he was spelling out a word. B-O-U-D-J-A-N. Caribou Jean.
Caribou Jean?
Does that mean anything to you?
Great Scotland Yard. Oh. That's extraordinary.
What is?
Worthington's have a half-price sale on bowler hats.
Really, Thompson? This is hardly the time. Great Scotland Yard.
What is it? Kane's a half-price too.
Are you going to take charge of this evidence?
Great Scotland Yard, indeed. The Thompson inspectors, they are hapless always. Michael Farr in Berlin. First, what did you think of Spielberg's movie? Does he get it right? Does he get it?
Well, it's a great film. It's very exciting. It's real edge-of-the-seat stuff. And what I love about it is the books are great page-turners. You know, they're so exciting. And so is the film. So it matches that. And the other thing about the books, which makes them, I think, so wonderful, is the humour. There's so much humour in the books. Well, I think Spielberg's film has a lot of humour, too. So hats off to him for, I think, making the best Tintin film which has been made to date.
I was really drawn to the story of how Steven Spielberg, way back when he was young, 1983, being put on to the Tintin stories. This was back in his Indiana Jones days. Being scheduled, as I understand it, to actually meet with Hergé in 1983, and within that same week, Hergé died. They never met, but the widow of Hergé gave the film rights to Spielberg, and on goes the story. Is that right?
That's right. Well, actually, even a bit earlier, I think Spielberg contacted Hergé in 82, earlier in 82, about the possibility of film rights, and suggested that Hergé should come over to Los Angeles in the fall of 82. But Hergé was a very sick man then and was unable to. And he sent over a team from his studios in Brussels who had a very positive meeting with Spielberg. And it was agreed that Spielberg would come at the end of March to Brussels to talk it over with Hergé himself. Now, what I was very excited about was when I was writing a biography of Hergé, I found a note he had left, dated January 1983. And in this note, he says, "If one person can bring Tintin successfully to the screen, it's this young American director." Now, he didn't name Spielberg, but we know it was him because he had a diary entry for the end of March, you know, for that meeting with Spielberg. And he died on the 3rd of March. So the meeting never happened. But as you said, Spielberg bought the rights for the first time later that year.
Thought of it, Spielberg did reportedly as Indiana Jones for kids, thought about having Jack Nicholson back in the day. This would have been a much younger Jack Nicholson playing Captain Haddock, and here we are all these years later with all these stories that fans know so well. The Blue Lotus, King Ottokar's scepter, where he tweaks Hitler and Mussolini, the crab with the golden claws, the secret of the unicorn, Red Rackham's treasure. Michael Farr, standby in Berlin. Lots of callers here. Chris in Grafton, Massachusetts. Thanks for calling, Chris. What's your Tintin story?
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was first exposed to these wonderful books when I got one for Christmas from European relatives. Way, way back, early 60s. And they were just, you know, unknown in the United States. I think they're, for the most part, still not well known in the States, but I have the feeling that's going to change in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, I should say so. And I think it's a series of films that he has going on. Do you have a moment from these books?
Every Saturday morning, I hope there'll be a new one.
Not that fast, I don't think. But I think Peter Jackson's scheduled to maybe direct another one on down the line. What about the stories themselves? Is there a moment that comes back to mind, Chris?
Yes, there is. It's one of my favorite moments from all of literature, actually. The professor and the captain and Tintin were being chased by soldiers, and they stole a soldier's tank. And the professor was unconscious, and the captain was saying, "Oh, he's in a bad way, Tintin. Drive carefully." And Tintin replied, "I'm trying, Captain, but this is the first time I've driven a tank since we were on the moon."
That is the boy. That is the boy wonder himself, Michael Farr. He could do practically anything, and he did it with a kind of a cool-headed quality, I mean, always questioning those sort of eyes that were just sort of dots in the face. You could imagine yourself in that face, which was part of the charm, I suppose. But there was nothing beyond Tintin, nothing he wouldn't take on in his blithe way.
There wasn't. I think Chris has found a very good moment in the Calculus Affair. That's a wonderful moment, a wonderful example of how Tintin, unlike perhaps you or me, or perhaps not, can fly any aeroplane, can drive any car, motorcycle, or
tank.
Bring it on. But your point is so good, because what's the great success formula is that Tintin is just two dots for eyes, that little button for a nose, and he's very abstract, very ambiguous. This means that every reader, boy, girl, whatever the age you are, whatever culture you come from, whatever continent you come from, can identify with Tintin and step into the hero's shoes. But the characters around him, Haddock and Calculus, we were just talking about in that tank, are very clearly defined. You can see every wrinkle on their faces and so on. So it's a very real context. And this is a great success formula because the reader is really engaged. It's not only Tintin who's the hero, but the reader becomes the hero in these ultra-realistic, you know, settings.
There was so much reality in the background. It wasn't just kind of a blur of background. If it was a spaceship on a launching pad, you saw that launching pad in great detail. If it was a...
Every detail is carefully done and accurately done.
Marianne in Charlottesville, Virginia. Marianne, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Yes, I wanted to ask the Tintinologist. I grew up reading Tintin, but I grew up in French countries. So
okay, yes. Where, in France or Africa or Vietnam?
In West Africa. My dad was in the Foreign Service.
Mm-hmm.
But we had all the Tintin and Asterix and Lucky Luke, but Tintin was just the best story. But I wanted to know, when I grew up, I always thought that the Africa one was the first one because it was the first one, as far as I knew, Tintin au Congo. And on the back of the Tintin, when they listed it, they did not mention the one au Pays des Soviets. And I didn't hear about that one until I was a teenager, and I think it was banned when I was a kid. And do you have any idea why that would have been?
That's interesting. Tintin Congo is the first one. What about it, Michael Farr?
No, well, your observations are quite right, but I shall explain why that's so. Tintin au Congo was the first of the colour Tintin books. It was put into colour after the war. What happened is that all the Tintin adventures were originally written in black and white for the newspaper. Mm-hmm. They were black and white things. But from 1942 onwards, and then with the Shooting Star, and then at the end 1944-45... all the books which had already appeared in black and white were progressively put into colour, into the familiar colour editions, the 62-page colour editions. And if, therefore, you count the ones in colour, you are indeed right. The first colour one is Tintin au Congo. But Tintin in the Land of the Soviets is the first, but he was never put into colour because Hergé thought it was his very first work. He thought it wasn't perfect. He didn't want it to be put in colour. Mm. He allowed it finally to be published in a facsimile edition in 1973, facsimile black and white. So it isn't part of the colour canon. Mm. But if you include all 23 and a half, or 24 if you include the facsimile final edition of the unfinished Alphard, Soviets is, of course, the first, which was begun on January the 10th, 1929. Mm. And the Congo then followed exactly a year later, its serialisation, the newspaper subsequently published in a black and white book, and then in 1946 published in a colour edition. Mm.
Marianne, thanks for your call. Stanley in Boston, you're on the air, Stanley.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
Very well.
This is such a fun subject. I grew up reading Tintin in French, but it was in Haiti.
Okay.
And I remember, I mean, we were poor. We didn't have a lot of money, but I would buy used edition. So I would save every penny, and once a month I'd go down to the market to find the latest used edition I can find of Tintin.
What did you like about it, Stanley? What did you like or even love about it?
Well, it was, there were so many things. One of the things I remember is that I couldn't decide whether it was a man or a boy because he looked funny,
yeah.
But he did dress like a boy.
Yes.
It's not boys in Haiti. So I just couldn't make up my mind what was he really. And the other thing is that in Creole, the word Tintin means idiotic things.
Oh, gosh. Hey, Stanley, let me ask you. You grew up in Haiti. What did you make of Hergé's representation of black people, of Africans? It could be pretty loaded, kind of old racist caricature back in the day. Did that bother you as a boy?
As a child, no, because there was a lot of those type of discrimination, I should say, also in Haiti, because lighter-skinned people get better treatment than dark-skinned people.
Yeah.
But again, this was a cartoon, so I was just interested about the story. I didn't pay attention to the social commentaries that were being made in the story.
Stanley, I appreciate your call so much, and we'd like to imagine you there in Haiti getting those secondhand copies, the secondhand editions of Tintin. Michael Farr, please stand by in Berlin. I'm very happy to welcome into the studio right now a very special reader of Tintin, certainly special to me. Born Robert Guichard in Paris, 1930. Robert Guichard emigrated to the United States, created a wonderful family, including one beautiful daughter that I married, my father-in-law, Robert Guichard, Papa Guichard, beau-père, welcome.
Hi, Tom.
It's very nice to have you here.
Yeah.
Take us
long
back.
Long time no see.
Yeah, well, visiting Boston from Oregon today, and how wonderful that is for the holidays. Take us back to you as I picture you as a pretty scampy young French boy on the streets of Paris, maybe 10 years old, 1939, 1940. Where did you see Tintin? Where did you get them? How did you get hold of these comic books?
Two things. First of all, I would go and buy the book, Tintin, and I remember the Blue Lotus, for example.
Set in China.
That's right. And I would buy it secondhand, not new. I would go along the Seine and buy it from these bouquinists, so they call
the little,
them.
The little book peddlers on the left bank of the
yes.
Seine there.
Mm-hmm. And most of the time when I was in boarding school, I would exchange my food against...
For some coins to buy used Tintin editions.
Or just an exchange, books for food.
Books, so you'd rather
this
read Tintin...
early in the war.
In the wartime, this is when the Nazis had arrived in Paris already.
Yes.
To read Tintin, you would trade your food, and food was not plentiful.
No. I specifically, what my friends wanted was the jam and the honey. And I had plenty of jam and honey in the early years of war.
Your Parisian uncle had a little kind of back channel, black market access to these.
That's right. And I gave everything for these books. And I read them, and I kept them for many years after that.
Now, we were talking about Tintin, and you candidly said you loved Tintin, but there were others that you also loved, maybe even more at that time.
Well...
Like what? Maybe Michael Farr will know them.
Before I say anything else, I read Tintin. I said Tintin, not Tintin.
You're entitled.
And for us in France, it was Les Aventures, the Adventures of Tintin et Milou.
The dog,
Milou
Snowy. Milou
was
the dog. Yeah, yeah.
They
equal
always
billing.
One with the other, not alone.
Yeah.
Okay. And what your people didn't say a while ago is that Milou was a speaking dog.
Very much so.
He spoke to Tintin.
With a sense of humor, dry sense of humor.
That's right, that's right. And I love the, it was adventures, it was science fiction, it was mystery.
But Tintin was kind of a goody two-shoes. He was a real good boy. I have a sense of you as kind of a kid on the streets, a little rougher than Tintin. Was he too nice for you?
No, he was not too nice. No. I like them both, Milou and Tintin. And Milou was... he was always helping Tintin in all these stories, except when he found a bone. When he found a bone, he forgot about Tintin completely.
He dropped everything else.
Dropped everything else.
I don't know. I remember the great stories of you snatching cookies away from German Nazi soldiers, lying on the lawn around the Eiffel Tower and running at top speed and stuffing your mouth with these biscuits, these cookies as you ran. I think you were a bit more of a rascal than Tintin.
Yes. I may add that I read Tintin in German and, of course, in English later when it was translated in about 1951. It was fun to read it in other languages, too.
But French first, and maybe French always the best for you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Of course.
Was he beloved by all your mates in those days? Did all the boys wait for the latest... Tintin?
No. Except the first three or four titles of Tintin, we read. After that, I didn't read them anymore.
There were a few other things going on.
I had the occasion to read them. Those that were made much later.
They came out for a long time, for many years, and in those years of the 1940s, in Nazi-occupied Paris, there were a few other things going on as well.
Also, long before Spielberg, there were movies made in French of Tintin.
Of course.
In the early 40s and 50s, rather.
Irresistible for a filmmaker, now coming out from Steven Spielberg. My father-in-law, Robert Guichard, there early on, buying those editions used on the left bank of the Seine. Thanks so much for coming in for a few minutes, Beaupère. Great to see you.
Just one last thing.
We're up against a break. You'll have to hold it. Hang on. Tintin, Michael Farr, we'll be right with you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about intrepid boy hero, boy reporter, world traveler, adventurer, Tintin. In theaters next week in Steven Spielberg's The Adventures of Tintin, The Secret of the Unicorn. Michael Farr joins us today from Berlin, Germany, top Tintinologist, author of Tintin & Co. and The Adventures of Hergé, creator of Tintin, and Tintin, The Complete Companion, just reissued in 2011. And boy, is it full of wonderful images and the backstory of how Hergé put all this together. Also with me for just another minute here in the studio, and wonderful to have him, my own father-in-law, Robert Guichard. Born Robert Guichard, Parisian, grew up in the streets of Paris. Plenty of reading Tintin there. Trading food for Tintin. Lots of wonderful comments here online. We've got Chandlery says, looking forward to a visit to Marlin Spike Hall, Haddock's home there. Corky says, Blue Lotus, Black Gold, the one about the pharaohs, all pre-political correctness genius. Well, I guess it all depends where you stand, but we hear that. Nagme writes, my memories of Tintin are from my childhood in Iran in the 1980s. All his books were available in Persian and about 50 other languages, I should say. And we, my friends, would circulate them amongst ourselves, devour them. He never felt culturally different or alienating, even though we were a bunch of Iranian teenage girls. And Laura writes, my favorite part is the one in which the Thompson twins end up in an acrobatic plane show, simply a series of pictures of them in the air. I remember reading this book, I think it's The Black Island, late at night in my bed and being unable to stop laughing. I must have been 8 years old then. Papa Guichard, you were about to tell us one last story about Tintin. Yeah. One thought.
Well, everybody knows that Tintin was translated in so many languages. I want to conclude with one quote from somebody that everybody has heard of, Charles de Gaulle.
Yes, we've
and
heard.
And Charles de Gaulle said once, my only international rival is Tintin.
I love it.
That's what he said.
From the great de Gaulle himself. Wow, terrific, terrific. Robert Guichard, my beloved father-in-law, thank you so much for bringing us your Paris stories today. Thank you, sir. Mm-hmm. Here's a little bit more from the Spielberg movie. Always want to ask questions. Boy reporter Tintin, Tintin, played by Jamie Bell, finds the time to keep asking even when danger is close at hand. Here's a scene where Tintin and Captain Haddock, played by Andy Serkis, meet for the first time in hot pursuit. Haddock's not so quick to chat and make friends.
We have to reach a locked door at the end of this corridor. This is going to be tricky.
You wouldn't happen to be related to the Haddocks of Marlin Spike Hall, would you?
Why do you ask?
Well, it's for a story I've been working on. An old shipwreck that happened off the coast of Barbados. A man of war, triple masted, 50 guns.
What do you know of the Unicorn?
Not a lot. That's why I'm asking you.
The coast of Barbados, a man of war, triple-masted 50 guns, and you're in Tintin country. Hillary in New Haven, Connecticut. Hillary, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to tell you that my 8-year-old son, Juan Sebastian, was introduced to Tintin when he was 6 by my husband, who's Colombian, who read Tintin as a boy. So he reads Tintin in Spanish and in English, and he's a huge fan, and he got another friend of his addicted to it, and they're going to both go to the movies. They're very excited.
It must be a great motivator for your 6 to 8 year old son to learn to read. This is not always simple vocabulary, Hillary.
Yeah, no, he's a strong reader, and he's also a huge fan of Calvin and Hobbes as well. But you know, I want, like a couple of months ago, he was deep, you know, reading in a Tintin book, and he was very engrossed. And I said, "What are you reading?" And he looked up and he said, Tintin, he's deep in Chinese territory.
The 8-year-old's perspective. Hillary, thanks for your call. Arnab in Acton, Massachusetts. You're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I grew up in India reading Tintin and other European comics like Asterix, Lucky Luke, and all that. And Tintin was the all-time favorite, actually. And I know the stories almost by each and every frame. I have just 2 points to make, and I also originally read them in Bengali, my own mother tongue.
Okay.
And I believe that's the first language in India that it was translated into. And I have just 2 points to make. I love Spielberg, but I just hope he does not overdo it. And number two, I am absolutely crestfallen that Professor Calculus was left out. And I would like to know if your guest has any comment on that.
Let us take it to Michael Farr. And Arnab, thanks so much for your call. We're now thinking of Tintin in Bengali. What a wonderful thought. Michael Farr, is it true? No Professor of Calculus? This is the absent-minded professor, half-deaf physicist. He's not in Spielberg's film?
It is. And I was a bit surprised, too, because, of course, you know, he first appears in the Ed Rackham's Treasure, which is the sequel to The Secret of the Unicorn, and I was expecting him, too. But I gather he's going to appear very soon in the next Spielberg film, so we don't have to wait much longer. Spielberg, like all filmmakers, has a bit of license. He has to have. I think if you turn a book into a film, you have to have a bit of freedom. And so it's not exactly as you... There will be things, and I won't say now what they are, because I want you to be surprised, but there will be things which will be slightly different from the book. But what I think is that it's done very much in the spirit of the book and in the spirit of Hergé, and therefore is commendable. And it's particularly good because what's going to happen, it's bound to happen, is that people who are not familiar with these great books, which your listeners have been, you know, saying how much they and their children enjoy them, but those who are not familiar will surely now buy the books. And, you know, I always say once you read a Tintin adventure, it's a pleasure for life. You know, you're hooked. It's wonderful. So I think that's marvellous. I think it's so great that your caller has come from the subcontinent, because there's a huge following in India and it's wonderful. I mean, this is an example. When I knew Hergé in the 70s, he showed me a letter he had got sent from a boy in Delhi, a 10-year-old boy in Delhi, addressed to Mr. Tintin, Brussels, and it had been delivered to Hergé, and he said, "This really moves me. There's a 10-year-old boy in India who loves Tintin, which I created for young Belgians all those years ago." And this is fantastic. This is the appeal of Tintin.
Well, we've got more questions for you. Here's one from Chris in California, and he asks does the new film have an imperial vision and/or an imperial nostalgia? Of course, this grew out of the heyday of Western imperialism. Is it possible to extract that from Tintin, or is it inevitably, inerasably there?
I don't think it's there. I think we don't have that in the film at all. I think the film is, it's very much a 21st century rendering of Tintin. It's wonderful family entertainment. And I think, it's very modern. And the technology makes it this amazing motion capture, which has been taken, to new extremes. I mean, it is quite extraordinary. You will see things in the cinema which you've never seen before.
Motion capture like Peter Jackson used with Gollum in Lord of the Rings, I think. Some of that...
Absolutely, but even more, it's become even more sophisticated. So you have these real actors performing as they would as real actors, but appearing much more, like the figures we know in the books, and the three-dimensional aspect and everything. It is quite extraordinary.
Here's Katie asking on Facebook. She says, "I've heard some libraries are pulling copies of Tintin, in other words, pulling them out of the library, because they are not inclusive." She says, "Please tell me this is an urban legend." Now, you're sitting in Berlin. I don't know how this goes in Europe. Some American libraries are very careful about respect for diversity. I can imagine it happening, but have you heard of it?
I think that's a bit of an urban legend. What I do know is one or two bookshops have moved Tintin in the Congo to the, as it were, from the children's department to the general reading department, because it does have a band across it saying, this was a product of its time and portrays Africa in a way which, we don't see Africa now, and Hergé wouldn't, as he told me himself, wouldn't portray it if he had done it later.
Did he have that observation himself, that these were a product of another time? I mean, these came out for decades.
Yes. No, absolutely. No, he was aware of it. And he said, I was doing what, how we Europeans saw Africa then, which is true enough, he was doing what filmmakers, authors were doing in Europe and indeed in the States. And there was nothing exceptional about that. And he says if he had done it now, in other words, when I knew him in the 70s, of course, he would have done it very differently. He, as a man, was most enlightened, the most, liberal person. So it wasn't because he had any racist views, far from it, So I think the urban legend is a good way of putting it. I must remember that.
Stephanie in Cambridge, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Stephanie. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just have two comments. Mm-hmm. I grew up in France reading Tintin, and I love Spielberg, but I have to say the French citizen in me is a little bit dismayed that this movie is going to be made by an American. And then my second comment is that I never felt I could identify with any of the characters in Tintin, because there's really no good female character. And so I feel like my brother really loves the books, but I had a harder time falling in love with them.
Yeah, that's interesting. Let us pick both of those up, Stephanie, and I appreciate your call. Michael Farr, Stephanie, growing up in France, dismayed that an American Spielberg's making the film. Of course, it's hardly the first time, as Robert Guichard, my father-in-law, was saying. I suppose, and I mean, Americans make everything. We make Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and it was in Swedish about 5 minutes ago.
Yes, I mean, it's the first time an American has had a go at Tintin. As you said, there were in the 60s, there were the French director André Barré did renderings, as your father-in-law said. But first time an American. But what your listener must remember is that Hergé himself was a huge cinema buff, and he was a great admirer of the young Steven Spielberg and made a point of seeing all his films. And he, as I said earlier in the programme, this was his filmmaker by choice to do Tintin. You know, I think that we can relax on that point, that Hergé himself would have liked to have seen this film. That I have no doubt about.
And what about
as for women in Tintin?
Yes.
As for women in Tintin, there is this wonderful figure of Bianca Castafiore, who becomes progressively more glamorous as the series goes on. This is because Hergé himself became very inspired by the beautiful Maria Callas, the opera singer, who converted him to opera. And suddenly, Castafiore, who was very unglamorous before the war, suddenly in the 50s becomes rather, you know, rather fetching in her designer Chanel and Dior dresses. So there is this pivotal female figure. I would also encourage your listener to look at the women in the background in Tintin, who are often, always beautifully dressed, often very beautifully portrayed. Mrs. Clarkson, the film maker's wife who leaves the theatre early in the Seven Crystal Balls, is an absolute Hitchcock blonde. And the other thing I'd say is a lot of girls I know who are such huge Tintin enthusiasts actually identify with Tintin himself, which goes back to what I said earlier about, you know, the ambiguity of Tintin being a fairly blank figure. So I think that, you know, in fact, I'd say not only is there a lot in it for girls, but from my own experience in Europe and indeed on a recent trip to the States, girls are in the ascendant. I think there are more and more girls are coming over to Tintin, and they may be in the majority, which is tremendous.
Well, we'll see. And Bianca Castafiore, just to say it, no wonder she turned Tintin's head, Hergé's more and more. Gabriel in Charlestown, New Hampshire. Gabriel, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
Yes.
I didn't grow up with Tintin, but I was just backpacking through Guatemala a couple weeks ago, and turns out my girlfriend did grow up with Tintin. We were in a backpacker's lounge, and one Englishman was looking through the available videos, and the excitement just jumped out of him when he saw Tintin, and the whole place filled with people from different cultures, and there were two Dutchmen sitting next to us. My girlfriend has roots in France, and the English couple, there was an Indian couple. Everyone just hushed, and it went from this party atmosphere to an excitement for Tintin as the video came up.
A global Tintin fest in Guatemala, no less, among the backpackers. Gabriel, I love that story, and I thank you for it. Michael Farr, what about, of course, it wasn't long, sadly, for Hergé before Belgium became Nazi-occupied Belgium while he was creating Tintin books. How did that affect the kind of stories he told? And what about the raised eyebrows about Hergé during the war and his sort of interactions with the Nazis themselves and their view on the world?
Well, Tintin had been going along happily on his adventures and successfully for 11 years, from 1929 to 1940, when the Germans invaded and occupied Brussels. And the immediate effect of that for Hergé and Tintin was that the paper which Tintin appeared in, the 20e siècle, the Petit 20e, the children's supplement of it, was closed down immediately because it was a Catholic newspaper and therefore considered, you know, hostile to the German administration, possibly. And so Tintin and Hergé were without work. However, the phone rang fairly soon afterwards, and the editor of Le Soir, which is now and was then Belgium's leading daily newspaper.
And conservative.
or conservative, but the main, you know, the top paper in Belgium, asked if he'd bring Tintin over to L'Espoir and he would create a children's supplement as had existed for the, in the other paper, especially for Tintin. So, of course, Hergé was delighted because L'Espoir had a much bigger readership. What was unfortunate was within a matter of weeks, the Germans, who also realised the importance of L'Espoir, took control of it. So, in effect, it became a paper which was collaborating with the German authorities. Now, this was all right to begin with because Tintin was tucked away in his children's supplement. But when paper shortages set in, he started appearing in the main pages of the paper, which unfortunately were also reporting Nazi successes on the Eastern Front against, you know, the Soviets and so on. And as I said, that was, in a sense, unfortunate. But the very positive side about it is, which is what your father-in-law hinted to about as a boy in France in, during the occupation reading Tintin, is that Belgians read Tintin to cheer them up. So, you know, they may not have been supporting them, or they weren't supporting the Nazis, but they still followed Tintin, and Tintin was very important for them to sort of keep their morale going in Belgium, and as your father-in-law, you know, indicated, in France too. So he was criticised after the war, and he regretted it. And I remember talking to him years later, and he said, well, yeah, I said to him, you know, if he had gone to Britain and continued Tintin in Britain, and the RAF would have dropped it as propaganda on Belgium, wouldn't that have been, you know, the answer? And he said, wouldn't that have been marvellous? If only I would have realised that or could have done it. So, you know, but he did get a certain amount of flack for that, but it was unfair, and he felt it very deeply. He thought it was desperately unfair, and, you know, he never really quite got over that criticism because he thought it was not right. Mm.
The story of Hergé, creator of Tintin. Tintin, the story, the adventures of Tintin, the secret of the unicorn, from Steven Spielberg and Peter Jackson in theaters next week. Michael Farr has been with us, the great Tintinologist, author of Tintin, The Complete Companion, really quite a volume, joining us today from Berlin, Germany. Michael Farr, thank you so much for being with us. What a delight to have you today. Thank you for your time.
Well, thank you. It's been a great pleasure talking to you and your marvelous listeners.
And thanks, as ever and always, to Papa Guichard, my good father-in-law, and his memories of reading Tintin in streets of Paris in 1940. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.